Europe is complicated. Let me get this straight. Kurt Straight, previously in Europe, French road safety.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Previously in Europe. I'm one of your co-hosts, Hugh, and I'm here with my lovely co-host, Kieran.
Hi.
Yeah, that's right.
Everything is a lie.
Well, except for the stuff we're going to talk about. That's all.
Oh, of course. Yeah, yes, yes. That's... We are the one true source of information. Only listen to us. Yeah. That's a terrible idea.
Yeah, and also, then, where are we getting our information? Do we gather it all independently?
Yes.
Yes.
We absorb information, like some sort of, like, I don't know, sunflower.
Yes, that's how sunflowers work. To rescue this drastically decreasing in quality podcast, I'm going to move on. So this week we have two great topics for you. One, we're going to talk about Ukraine and how it's totally not getting invaded as we speak.
But maybe not when we release the podcast.
Yes, yeah, right. Correct, depending on what the news of Monday morning is. And the Yellow Vest protest in France and the various fun around that. We're probably going to talk about that quite briefly because it's, you know, still ongoing. So it's kind of hard to be sure that everything won't have changed dramatically by the time the podcast comes out. So we're going to touch on the main crux of the points, I think. But before that, we're going to do our recurring nonsense section where we discuss pieces of news that each of us have been looking at this week, but isn't large enough to talk about as a full topic and kind of just want to mention relatively briefly. I'm going to open it with a couple of pieces of nonsense I enjoyed. One of which, because we didn't have a full episode last week, we missed this, but Andrej Babiš, the Czech Prime Minister, had a no-confidence vote, which he only survived by 9 votes. Because, for people who don't remember, Babiš runs quite a unstable coalition with the Communist, including the Communist Party in the Czech Republic. Mm. It's not really aligned with the man who ran as, like, pro-business. I know what to do because of business reasons. I was initially being, like, pegged as, like, is this the Czech Trump? And Babiš and Trump aren't actually that similar. Zeman is more the Czech Trump.
Oh, very much so. I would really like if Trump, like, took over the presidency and was like, I'm going to work with the communists.
That'd be a twist.
Quite the twist.
Yeah, and I think his supporters would be very confused due to the history of communism in the US. What triggered this, it was kind of like a growing kind of like steady trucking along of the EU fund scandal that Babiš is embroiled in, where he is supposedly took several million euros in funds from the EU illegitimately and applied for EU grants that he wasn't, like, legally applying for. And his son claimed that he had been kidnapped and brought to Crimea. This is before Crimea was part of Russia.
Oh, okay.
I think it was.
So he was just kidnapped and brought to, like, a sunny destination in southern Europe.
Yes, yeah. So this is one of Babiš's points about why this might not be the case. He says his son was on holidays and is mentally unstable and says his son has schizophrenia, I believe is what he said.
Right.
But basically his son gave an interview where he said the EU was interested in talking to him as part of his investigation, and he was mysteriously brought to Crimea so that he couldn't testify against his father. Babiš is effectively like, this isn't true. And it's unclear whether or not this is true. I'm gonna go on the side of maybe it is. Yes. But I think a notable thing about the no confidence vote is President Zeman, who was very pro Babiš in that election, said that if Babiš had lost no confidence vote, he would have just asked Babiš to form another government, as he has done previously when Babiš's government hasn't been stable enough. So Babiš's party don't really have another person to lead if they have to get rid of him, and the rest of his coalition don't want another election because none of them are polling particularly well, so they all kind of want to avoid it. So it's not surprising that he didn't. That he survived their confidence vote, but it's kind of interesting that the reasons behind it, I guess, are nonsensey. Another piece of nonsense I wanted to touch on briefly is that Kosovo has gotten messy again. They have imposed a 100% tariff on all Serbian goods, which, if you look at a map briefly and see the enormous border between Serbia and Kosovo, you'd realize, well, that's a problem on a lot of the border between Serbia and Kosovo, no?
Oh, yes. Almost certainly.
Yeah. And previously there was a 10% tariff, which to me sounds quite high for, like, imports from, like, in rural regions especially, like, which is a lot of the border, is, like, you know, regions where a 10% tariff seems, like, unenforceable, for one.
How else are we going to get this, like, Kosovar industry booming, though? We have to be very discriminatory towards all our outside neighbors, especially the one that wants to eat us.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I think, you know, if your economy is ever not going as well as you want, strong protectionism is just the way forward. That's been proven time and time again. So Serbia has kind of implied that it wouldn't be unusual if Kosovo moved forward with their plans to form an army, which they're kind of not super supposed to do based on the tenuous agreements that are in place that mean that Kosovo isn't currently being invaded by Serbia, who still maintain Kosovo as part of Serbia. The US State Department has made some, like, vague claims along the lines of, we support Kosovo gradually renaming their defense force, like, peacekeeping people as their army and forming that slowly. You're like, well, this has gotten super, super messy as usual, but, you know, here we go.
Fantastic. So I think I'll talk a little bit about some of the nonsense that I had this week, which is the general nonsense of Kieran's long-living passion, and one of the main points of our podcast of no election left behind. Mm-hmm. This is a mantra of the podcast, and we are doing that to the fullest. I'm going to talk about first the Georgian presidential election, which in 2018, this is, I think, the last one. There's amendments to the constitution in 2017 that means that this is going to be the last direct presidential vote.
Yep.
After 2018, presidents will be elected by a 300-member college of electors. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's not going to be a directly elected position. So,
but how does the college of electors, how do they, how is that, do we know how that's formed yet? Or is that, like, up in the air somewhat?
I think that's either up in the air or has not been translated to English yet. So, from our perspective, it might as well be up in the air.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so it's a two-round system, and there was a lot of people contesting the first round. If I remember correctly, it was, that's a big laundry list. I'm going to eyeball that as about 20, 20 plus candidates, but like only about like 8 actually got above 1%.
Okay, yeah, so yeah. I think if you look at a lot of... like, in a lot of countries, like, you kind of... Like, if you look at the US, for instance, like, there's the list
so
of people...
You actually go to the full list.
Yeah, the list of people technically running for president in at least, like, one or two states is enormous, but it's, like, a lot of them are only on the ballot in, like, one place or a couple of places. It's not really a serious
thing.
Anyway.
So the interesting thing about this election, or at least, like, the only interesting thing, because it wasn't a terribly interesting thing, there was a second round, and the candidate... Georgian names. Salome Zurabishvili.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. She won.
Yeah.
She is the first directly elected female president of Georgia.
Yeah.
Because there's been periods when it was like an appointed president and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So that's good. She won against her her opponent, Grigol Vashavje. Oh dear. He looks very smiley and has a mustache. He kind of looks like a little bit like a cleaned up Santa Claus.
Anyway, cleaned Santa Claus who's a loser,
who lost. Back to the North Pole with you. Anyway, the reason that I find it kind of interesting is that the polls were not predicting she would win. Mm. Pretty much all polls. So let's see. Yeah, all polls kind of had her as, like, the most... here's how to put it. All polls before the second round happened, before the first round, I should say, had her with the, like, most percentage.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes, like, one or two odd... Every so often there was a poll that had this guy, George and Santa Claus, as like as being the most votes. Mm-hmm. But then after the first round happened, he was winning in like every poll.
Yeah.
Except for exit polls, obviously.
And there was a Gallup poll in mid-November where she was winning.
Yes, yeah.
But that was a standout. Like everything else was.
That was a standout. Yeah. Like some of them are like 70-30%.
Yeah.
Like swings. These are ridiculous polling. This might just be an indication of how terrible polling is in the state of like in the country of Georgia.
Yeah.
More than anything.
Yeah, polling might not be good. That's true.
That might be a possibility. It was like or like our poll, like the methodology is just like we asked everyone in Abkhazia what they think is like, oh, you're not voting? Oh no. Why did we exclusively ask the people in Abkhazia?
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, Georgia has a new president and not really much to say after that. This is the party or the alliance. She's an independent, but there's an alliance and party system in Georgian politics. And the alliance that she's a part of is very much the governing alliance, Georgian Dream, as opposed to Strength is Unity, which these names always sound kind of terrifying to me. Like, they always sound like they're ready to be like really right wing, but then sometimes they're not.
Georgian Dream doesn't sound that right wing.
Depends what the dream is, I guess.
Yeah, but yeah, I'm assuming it's a positive dream for somebody.
Anyway, the other election that is worth kind of mentioning is we don't really do regional elections all that much, but
this is 2018.
Yes, yeah, there's a lot of regions, but there was the Andalusian election, which is for anyone who doesn't know, this is one of Spain's. Don't call it a state. You can't call it a state. It's not a federation. This is a centralized kingdom. Please don't call it a state. States. Andalusia is the one in the furthest south. It contains cities like Malaga, Seville, Cordoba, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most populous state, and I think it's the largest in land area as well in all of Spain.
I think it is.
Other thing you should probably know about Andalusia is like every stereotype you have about Spain probably comes from Andalusia. This is the region that like historically and culturally like did bullfighting, had like naps in the middle of the day because it was too hot because they are a stone's throw away from Morocco.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Yeah, yeah.
Forest fires.
Forest fires, yeah. But also they have Cadiz, which is like the gay rights capital of Spain, which is a very interesting place to be. I've been before. It's nice.
One might say it's flaming.
God damn it. Anyway. Andalusia, the other thing about it though is that since Franco died, Andalusia has been like a left-wing stronghold in Spanish politics. The center-left party has been governing there since Spain has become a democracy again. Usually with the support of a further left party. Which has changed, like who that further left party is has changed several times throughout that history, that 34 year long history. For example, in the most recent election, it was called the they were known as the AA, which is basically Andalusia Together in Spanish. And they are a collection of like left wing parties, both local and national. Podemos, like the Andalusian chapter of Podemos, is included in that. But also the other thing about Spanish politics is it's super granular, and you can like have parties that only exist in like one county and like are very particular to that county issue.
I think we mentioned before, there's like a I think it's not in Andalusia as well, there's like a party that is like made up of English speaking expats. Basically their entire thing is like local healthcare based agendas.
And translation of like bureaucratic services and things like that.
At
the same time, like if anyone's interested in like radical municipalism, that's like really kicking off in Barcelona because of the structure of Spanish politics, which is super interesting. But anyway, the reason we're talking about the Andalusian elections is that Spain's far-right party has, like, entered into the Andalusian, like, parliament. they got about they've got 12 seats now.
Yeah.
In percentage of vote, they got 11%.
Mm-hmm.
In number of seats, they are tying with, like, or rather, they got the same. Yeah, what is it? Yeah, they got the same seat change. Like, they gained the same amount of seats as the Cs. And this is pretty much being read as the only reason this is really happening is because the PP, Rajoy's party, but Rajoy is no longer in charge of it, the centre-right party of Spain is collapsing.
Mm-hmm. I suppose everyone senior in it is embroiled in the same corruption scandal.
Yes, basically, yeah.
Yeah.
But Vox has come along, and they are very right wing. They're like modeled after mostly National Rally or Le Front National, if you know them by their classical name. Yeah, so this is kind of worrying for some people because, one, this is the left-wing stronghold of Andalusia, of Spain, I should say. And Spain was kind of viewed as one of those countries that didn't have, like, wasn't being affected by this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There was kind of like this, this is definitely falling apart now, but there was this, like, received wisdom that a lot of the bailout countries, like, right-wing populism was not taking hold.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, you talk about, like, Alexis Tsipras and Syriza party in Greece, but then again, you also had Golden Dawn.
Hmm.
There's still like a left-wing government in Portugal that's like really popular according to their own polls.
Yeah.
And the far right in Ireland is just consistently a joke.
And but like in those countries specifically, the narrative is always, oh, but we have to talk about populism. We're going to mark whatever left-wing movement there is as populist to paint it with the same, like, negative politics brush. So you're like, Syriza, even though they've just spent like several years implementing austerity policy after austerity policy, for some reason they think Sinn Féin is a left-wing populist party. I'm not sure where they're getting that from. Like Podemos, yes, but they're put, like, as in that analysis does check out to a certain extent. But, you know, it's not really...
They're a left-wing populist, but I'll take Podemos over Vox any day of the week. Yeah,
exactly. Like, that's the thing, is that, like, then you see the right-wing version of it, and you're like, well, that's actually much worse.
Oh, this is gross. I don't like it.
Yeah.
Where are all these fact-checking videos? That's what I want from my Vox.
Yeah.
Last little thing from Kieran's, like... This is Kieran's anti-nonsense suggestion, because I really like this. It's made me happy and makes me feel good again.
Yeah.
I mean, you could take a very cynical angle on it, which I can talk about a little bit. But anyway, Luxembourg is giving away free public transport. By giving away, I mean they're making it the norm.
Mm-hmm.
All public transport in Luxembourg is going to be free,
mm-hmm.
Which is super cool. And it's not just free for Luxembourgish citizens. It will also be free to, like, people who reside and work in Luxembourg.
That's pretty good.
Because we've talked about this before. Like, it's like 43% of their population is non-Luxembourgish.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, like, I believe the last numbers I saw was like 200,000 people from, like, France, Germany, and Belgium, like, commute into Luxembourg. Yeah.
Luxembourg is one of those countries that when you're on the motorway, all the directions are either to Luxembourg City or to other countries. <It's> like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I would be like hard pushed to find a second city in Luxembourg. Like, if I was on the road, I'd be like, how do I get here? How does this work?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the plan is that all public transport will be free.
Yeah.
Which is pretty good. Luxembourg City has a population of about 110,000. But a further 400,000 come into commute to the city. Population of Luxembourg in total is 600,000, with an additional 200,000 coming in from neighboring countries.
Mm.
Luxembourg also has the unique problem for a lot of the other European countries where it has massive traffic jams.
Yeah.
Apparently, the average citizen spends about 33 hours in traffic jams on a yearly basis, well, at least in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's pretty cool, and I'd like to see this being implemented in other countries or other, like, cities in similar sizes to Luxembourg, because I think we were talking about this off mic or, like, earlier in the week, that Luxembourg as a size and a population is comparable to basically every city on the island of Ireland that isn't Dublin. Yeah, so like, if this works, and if it works well, which like most models seem to suggest, it'll be fine and it should work.
Yeah,
you might be able to push this policy in other countries.
Yeah, totally.
For anyone else interested in this kind of like stuff that's happening, Tallinn, the capital of Estonia, also has free public transport. The only side effect, only difference of that is that you have to be a resident of Tallinn, and they're doing tests in like, oh god, what's the city on the other side of Dover, in France? I've forgotten.
Calais.
Like, I think it's Calais. Yeah, actually. Yeah, they're testing out free public transport in some sort of port city in the north of France.
Yeah, I vaguely remember that as well. I think a quick cursory Google would find it, but yeah.
And it's a big city. It's not like nothing to turn your nose up at.
No, very true. I think I think the one place you won't see it is in Andalusia, once Ezra Klein becomes, you know, supreme ruler of Andalusia due to Vox becoming an important right-wing force. Like, they will have pro-business and anti-immigrant policies that I'm looking forward to. So moving on to our main topics. So our first topic I would like to discuss, Ukraine, because more important, or just like, you know, bit of the day news crops up, and then yet again the ongoing conflict in Ukraine just like slips away. There was a great moment like about a week ago where the conversation shifted from Ukraine back to or to Yemen for like the first time properly, and people were like, "Oh, there's like a big humanitarian crisis in Yemen." It was like, "Yes, that's been going on for years." Now you stop talking about Ukraine again. You go back to need to one thing at a time. Well, not one thing at a time, but talk about Ukraine more is my point. So this kind of became news again 2 weeks ago because of the whole Kerch Strait incident, where basically as one of the problems of Russia annexing Crimea is it cuts off like a big bit of Ukraine's coast, I believe, to like bits of like an exit called the Kerch Strait that goes between goes by Crimea that the Ukrainian navy and shipping used, and Russia have for the first time just kind of annexed three of Ukraine's ships and several navy members. Some things about this is that Russia are basically just saying like, oh, they're just trespassing on our land, so we're arresting them and impounding the ships, and they're just prisoners in Russia on like normal trespassing, like illegally entering the country grounds. And Ukraine are effectively saying like, so you're just like, so you're not holding the prisoners of war, you're just saying that they have illegally entered Russia, which is, you know, pretty notable because they just annexed a bit of Ukraine and are now just treating it as like a normal thing happening. And I think this is very different to Russia paying for mystery troops appearing in Crimea and mystery troops appearing in the east of Ukraine. That they're like, oh, they totally aren't Russian. This is just the Russian military is just arresting Ukrainian military members.
It's consistent with their like story, I guess. If their whole story is, no, we're not at war. Crimea came over to us voluntarily, and the people in Donetsk and Luhansk are not Russian or Russian backed at all. They're just, you know, rebels. Like this fits with their story kind of thing, but it's certainly weird to see it play out in such a large scale of like, we've taken some ships.
Yeah.
But it's not war.
No, but like, so Ukraine's response to this has been to propose bringing in 30 days of martial law.
Oof.
In basically all of the border regions to Russia, and then they're banning any Russian men between an age range of entering under suspicion of, well, previously they just casually had Russians wander in claiming they were just Ukrainians who were having a grassroots uprising against the government, and then mysteriously the Russian government came to like arm them, and we now know that almost certainly that was just Russia sneaking in people in they were wearing military uniforms, they just like camouflaged, they didn't have the Russian flag on them.
Yeah, they were unmarked military uniforms.
Yeah. So that's interesting. In a lot of ways, it's kind of unnecessary, because like the Donetsk region is one of the regions they're saying they're going to put under martial law, but effectively the Donetsk region is already under martial law, because it's full of separatists, and there's active military operations going on, and there's active fighting. So, there's that. And the response from the US has kind of been, we're looking into sailing a warship into the Black Sea. It's like, that one warship, that's great.
Good. Still probably not a good move either.
No, that's the thing. It's like, it's kind of just a... It's the way the US deals with a lot of these kind of military conflicts, especially with Russia, is like... it's the same way they dealt with Syria when Russia was like more actively involved. Well, actually, you know what, they're still pretty actively involved. But like when there was like a big influx of Russian activity in Syria, there was then, the US has now decided to like today reinforce a no-fly zone we previously participated in. And it's under the guise of, so Russia are doing stuff and then we're going to do stuff that like doesn't quite come into contact with them, but like means that they can't go into this area because we're there. And it's kind of taking that approach to it. So they're doing a similar thing in the off the coast of Japan, like just kind of sailing warships where like, it might be seen as aggressive for them to do that, but it's no actual action. And like at the end of the day, Russia is still effectively like annexing large parts of the Ukraine, and the response from like NATO countries has been, that's bad, don't do that. The two kind of other like bits of this is Russia, like on their various state media outlets, are saying that the martial law Ukraine is imposing on the border regions is a cover to start a East Ukraine offensive and retake the separatist regions. Because if it's under martial law, it's actually a lot harder to for people to notice that. And if there's restricted travel in and out of the region, it's harder to know what they're up to. But then the president of Ukraine is saying that there's pretty good evidence that Russia is massing troops on their eastern border. So a potential just full-on invasion of Ukraine might just start happening, and there might be larger swaths of those regions taken for the separatist bits that will eventually just secede into Russia, like the Crimea did. The Ukrainian president didn't mention timeline of this, but they've now like released screen grabs and stuff of like, you can see this, they're basically saying like, you can see this on Google Maps, it's big enough to just be visible on several day old satellite footage of this region that happened to be on clear sky day, I guess.
So the other thing to like take into account with all of this and the actions of Poroshenko is that there's a presidential election in Ukraine next year.
Yes.
And Poroshenko is not polling well.
No. And like Poroshenko's reasoning behind this is that people are afraid of like the Russian like influence of like fuel prices and stuff, and that's negatively affecting him in the polls. He'd probably still be doing badly, but doing something like this when a lot of the population not unreasonably views what's been going on in general in Ukraine, like in the east of Ukraine, as the Kiev government has no control over the situation. Having a mass up now makes sense for both political and like, well, if you're going to do something, you probably should have done something quite a long time ago, but and rallying other countries to come to your aid hasn't worked. So, except potentially there's one ship from the US, I don't know.
Oh, well.
It'll be fine.
Never fun.
Ukraine's getting invaded, probably this week or next week. We'll see.
Good news for Poroshenko is his polls have improved slightly because of the Kerch Strait incident.
Sure. They've improved slightly. I don't... Yeah, I think there actually is a real danger of the election happening and effectively, like, the status quo isn't... Like, the status quo, effectively, of they will just start recognizing the Donetsk region as separate, because if like, in practice is at the moment, will just be reinforced by the election result. I don't foresee a radical, like, hard stance on Russia position coming out of that election, but we will see, I guess. Some very, very light good news for Ukraine, though. The Merkel's potential successor, Ack, as I like to call her, is not very pro Nord Stream 2, and I will refer to the Nord Stream 2 episode we did, why Ukraine hates the Nord Stream 2. So that's potentially good, but she's actually not that strongly against it, so it might just happen anyway. We'll see.
Yeah, like she's said a couple of things, being like, I don't know about that, but that's basically been the extent of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah. I think there's a. I've been seeing a lot of U.S. news coverage of this, but it's very much in the guise of, because they want to talk about like Russia stuff, and generally how like Russia is like a big enemy we need to talk about, and the U.S. should consider getting involved militarily because they love a good war. It's very much like war coverage, whereas like most of the year they don't talk about it at all, and really the story is like a slow attrition because nobody is doing anything about it.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's a.
As we often say in the podcast, the situation in Ukraine is still going on.
I don't know if you mentioned that before, but the situation in Ukraine is still going on.
Oh yes, yeah. Hugh, have you heard? The situation in Ukraine is still going on. Ah. Oh, it's sad because it's true.
Not according to Ezra Klein.
Situation in Spain is still going on. Anyway, going on to our next topic of the evening is we're gonna talk a little bit about the Yellow Vest Movement, or Mouvement des Gilets Jaunes. It's been so long since I've done French.
That's pretty good. No, that sounds correct, because I've heard other people say it, and that's what they sound like.
Yay. The Jilly Junes.
Yeah.
God damn it. All right, so the Yellow Vest Movement. Let's give a little brief history of what happened there.
Mm-hmm.
So the kind of like, for anyone who doesn't know, the quick glance of it is there is large ongoing protest movements in France at the moment over... So what will be commonly reported is that there was a sales tax increase planned for petrol,
mm-hmm.
and or VAT, if you don't know what sales tax is, you know, the tax at the point of sale.
Yeah.
However, like, this caused people to go in the street wearing yellow high-vis vests, because those are required by law to be carried in your cars for, you know, road maintenance work and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the protests have gotten very big and have made a lot of footage that kind of like is good for news and has people in like other parts of the world relatively scared, etc., etc. One little thing I would like to say on top of that, though, is, or a couple of things we want to say on top of this, is that the sales tax petrol thing was very much a straw that broke the camel's back.
Mm-hmm.
Although I haven't been able to find many sources of this now, I do want to say that, like, you can disregard this if you want. I felt like at the beginning of this movement, or when it was starting to get press, that was very underreported. There was a lot of fixation on the sales tax rather than being like, actually, no, there's been a lot of other things that have been happening semi-slowly, but probably too quickly from the perspective of French people in terms of like tax and tax changes and social security cuts and things like that,
mm-hmm.
mainly under the Macron presidency, but it was happening under Hollande as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that kind of like built to this to show for that, like, I feel like media has gotten better at reporting this now and saying that that was a straw that broke the camel's back moment, and there was a lot of stuff going on beforehand. Examples of things that were going on beforehand is there was huge SNCF union strikes, as well as other like airport worker and airline worker strikes.
Yeah,
there was solidarity movements with like students with those strikes.
Mm-hmm.
Carrefour, which is like a supermarket in France but also like France's biggest employer,
mm-hmm.
Their like staff went on strike earlier this year, and that was big. He was talking about how he doesn't really recall ever seeing a supermarket in France that wasn't Carrefour.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of one. I'm like, it's either Carrefour or like another brand that's like Spar or something has like, you know, like
a European brand.
Yeah, like a European brand. But there's kind of like Carrefour is like ubiquitous. It is it is everywhere, and it makes perfect sense that it's France's biggest employer. Just, I think, whatever country you're in, just imagine, like, say the two biggest supermarkets that you're aware of. I think it would be I think it would be not dissimilar to, like, in the US, if, like, everyone in Walmart went on strike, or everyone in, like, Target or something, like a shop that is, like, ubiquitous and giant, as opposed to something that's, like, a fragmented industry.
So that's the kind of stuff that's been, like, building in the background in terms of strikes. In terms of, like, what Macron has been doing to deserve these strikes, quite a bit. I think we've talked about it a little bit in the show before.
We talked about the rail strikes a lot when they happened, because they were a big deal, and they went on for a long time. And that was effectively around, like, quite drastic changes that Macron was making to the rail company. And a lot of it was to take it in line with, like, it was, like, under the guise of taking it in line with, like, EU competition laws. But the problem is that, like, people, there's not actual support for those competition laws applying to the rail industry. And, like, a lot of it's kind of a problem people have with Macron in general, whereas his, like, pro-European tact and whatnot, everybody likes that in France generally. Like, that was what he was popular for, was being, like, not Marine Le Pen and being, like, a charismatic, relatively socially liberal, and then also pro-Europe person. The things they didn't like were, well, he wants to, you know, reform the French labor system and make it a lot more like the UK or the US, or, like, frankly, other European countries, make it more in line. Like, France is kind of notorious for having, like, a very, very strict labor laws, but those labor laws are actually very popular in France, and there's not necessarily great evidence that by liberalizing the labor laws, you would...
Money.
Yeah, exactly. The idea was, like, okay, unemployment is a problem, and one of the ways Macron viewed it was, it's too difficult to hire people because you have the fear of you can't get rid of the, like, everyone's impossible to fire. So, like, changing a lot of that really into the state rail company was, like, the state rail company was seen as, like, a, in a lot of ways, like, a pilot case for, like, the reforms he wanted to make more generally, and they were so reviled in the French rail company that, like, some of them ended up being walked back and changed, but, like, a lot of them ended up happening anyway. But, like, we covered that a lot when it happened, because they were a big deal. I think we kind of, because there was a lull of stuff not really happening and Macron getting a lot of stuff he wanted passed because he controls the parliament so strongly, that it seemed like, oh, stuff in France has kind of become okay again, and people have kind of, but like, it hasn't, people remember the rail company and labor reforms, and like, the Carrefour strikes would have been, like, were a big deal in France, they just weren't a big deal internationally,
because you have to explain what Carrefour is a good example of, like, how these French protests are remembering a lot of this stuff is, one of the things that are, like, a big sticking point for the Gilets Jaunes is that is the solidarity tax on wealth, which is sometimes just referred to as the fortune tax.
Yeah.
This was gotten rid of under Macron's government last year. I'm not sure if it has taken effect just yet, or if it had taken effect only recently. But yeah, this was a tax. This was a progressive tax that dealt with, like, incredibly wealthy people. And, like, that is something that's a common point of the Gilets Jaunes, the Yellow Vests movement, is that they want, they're constantly coming back to the idea that the expensive, the, they had an actual good quote on this. Let me see if I can find that. It's within their demands. It was something along the lines of, the big pay big, the small pay small. Idea of, like, they're very, as a movement, they're very for progressive taxes. That would probably be one way to say it. And seeing a cut to a progressive tax and then, like, and then adding a regressive tax, a tax that, like a sales tax, affects everyone. But does it affect everyone equally, because lots of people don't have the same amount of money as each other, you know?
Yeah.
Inequality and all that. Yeah.
Like, a big thing about that wealth tax is that it, like, applied to a very small number of people. So they're applied to 350,000 people, which sounds like a lot, but there's almost 70 million people in France. So actually,
second most populated in the EU. So,
So, like, it's actually an enormous country. So that's not that many people. And a lot of them wouldn't have been paying a lot of that tax. Like, there's a small number paying the bulk of it. And they reckon it brought in about 5 billion euros. And then the new version of it, the estimates are 1.5 billion euros. So you've effectively given a 3.5 billion euro tax cut to people with enormously high wealth because you're worried, because like the reason for doing it is like, oh, we think a lot of millionaires are leaving the country and therefore we need to lower their taxes so they don't leave. And it's like, well, no, like having millionaires resident in your country in no way guarantees that they like spend money there or start businesses there. A lot of this is like accrued wealth over time. That is not the intention. Is not to like they're not going to like reinvest that money in like a new business venture that's going to hire a lot of people. That's not like them being resident in the country has nothing to do with that.
The other stated goal of like cutting that tax was to attract the millionaires and billionaires of that might be leaving the UK because of Brexit.
Yeah,
and I think a couple of reports before the Gilets Jaunes stuff came out, or like started rather, a handful of reports within France were saying like that doesn't seem to be like getting rid of this tax doesn't seem to really change anything in that regard.
No, and it's not like a lot of like as with a lot of what Macron is doing, like his core argument with the train strikes effectively was, you really hate this now, but if I don't do this now, the train company will eventually become bankrupt, and then we'll have to like privatize the rail company completely. So instead, we're going to introduce these measures to make like the train company, you know, have less staff and have a lot of cost cutting in order to, and like liberalize labor laws within as relating to the rail company and change the pension setup a bit in order to make the rail company like an ongoing concern. And the argument eventually, but then so he's like, long term, this is a better call. And then the same thing with the millionaire and billionaire tax is just like, well, if we make it more hospitable for them, they will come here and spend all of their money starting businesses eventually, once like other countries don't have a more favorable like tax setup for them. It's kind of like the problem you have in the UK is like there's an awful lot of people, often surprisingly close and or in government, that are like non-UK, that are like UK resident and then end up not being UK resident at some point for like tax purposes. So like non-domicile status was a big thing in the UK, is a big scandal of people who were like often big political donors or like well-known business people.
Yeah.
And it's just sorry, there's a drill in my building somewhere which is a
Oh, okay.
Don't yeah, it seems to have stopped. Okay. They really don't like non-domicile status.
Other things, we should talk about in terms of Gilets Jaunes that, again, I feel like isn't being talked about quite a bit in like other media representations of this protest, is their demands.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of this is getting pitched as like general chaos in the streets of Paris, and oh, it's an aimless movement, they don't have demands, etc. Some of the, like, they do have demands. They have like about 40 demands, and from my perspective they're all pretty good. They want more progressive, like they want more slices in income tax, they want like more delineations, they want to eliminate homelessness, which I don't know about, like, because a lot of these kind of studies are often very limited to the linguistic sphere that are being talked about, but there have been studies to show that like it's very easy to end homelessness in the United States. Like, the money exists for it,
yeah,
to just like give everyone houses, and it would actually even be like a cost-cutting measure, because the money spent on like keeping homeless people like corralled and maintained and whatever is quite expensive, and it's a recurring cost.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's other things in here, like they want a maximum salary to be 15,000 euro a year. They want minimum wages to be tied to cost of living increases.
Sorry, no, they want the maximum salary as 15,000 euro a month.
Well, 15,000 euro a month, sorry, you're right.
Yeah, so it's the maximum salary of 270,000 or 220,000 ish.
Yeah. Yeah, but there's also things like, yeah, minimum wage being tied to cost of living.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see. Yeah.
Electoral reform. They want like Senate reform. They want they want class size numbers fixed. They want like corporation tax increases. It's an enormous they've included in there is like prohibition of glyphosate, which is like a big thing in the EU, and you can see why that would get wedged in as like a thing. There's some portion of these things. A lot of these things are not mutually exclusive, even though some people would argue they are, because like we can't spend that money on both of those things. And you're like, yeah, no, but. They're not claiming this is like a costed thing. They're saying like these are all things that you could find massive popular support for and aren't individually aren't like massively unrealistic. So like why haven't you done any of them, and why are none of them even on the cards?
Yeah, that's kind of it, isn't it? Some of this even gets into like very nitty gritty constitutional stuff when it comes to France.
Yeah.
That I would have to do more research to actually understand the impact of this stuff. Mm-hmm. But like people's referendum, changing the term limit on presidents, things like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it all seems to be kind of very like protecting the little guy, protecting the common people. There's a lot in here about disability payments, pensions, minimum wage, like I said previously.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a pretty decent list of demands.
Yeah.
I can't remember where I found these numbers. So again, don't quote me on this. But I remember seeing that it was like people just like batting away the myth that these are right wing protests, because people were saying that only the demands were only like 20% in line with the Front National party platform.
Yeah.
Whereas they were about like 75% in line with like La France Insoumise's platform.
Yeah.
So there was things like that, which. Again, I don't really have the numbers for in front of me, but that's an interesting one. They are rejecting support from traditional parties.
Yeah.
So that has people a little bit concerned as well, but see how that goes, I guess. I don't think it's like cause for concern or...
No, I think it makes sense because you're just like, well, do they want the... Like a lot of what they're complaining about are stuff that either started like under Hollande or like are still things that aren't... Like, a lot of this stuff isn't on the agenda for the Socialist Party, so why would they be like, yes, let's get on board with the Socialist Party?
Speaking of parties and people and breakdowns and stuff like that, we do have some polling that shows that about, like, 72% of the French public support the protests.
Yeah.
Which is something that, in some reports in other parts of the world that are a bit more, like, pearl-clutching...
Mm.
Don't really mention that it actually has quite a bit of popular support.
Yeah, and you can envisage the popular support in general isn't like a... You could view it as, oh, well, nobody likes fuel taxes. You could also view it as a... In the context of most of the reforms have been... they're saying they're doing this for climate reasons, but they all, like... The people, like... millionaires do not have a good track record on protecting the climate. Let's say that.
Yeah. The other one other thing that I kind of forgot to mention in terms of why people are protesting Macron, one thing that I kind of found out today while doing research for this is that the according to Amnesty International, the state of emergency that has been in place since the November 2015 Paris attacks has been used to clamp down on protests with authorities using emergency powers to stop protests related to the labor law reforms about 574 times. The whole state of emergency being used to clamp down on protests rather than what it was kind of, you know, originally pitched as being for, which is to stop terrorism.
Yeah.
So that's never fun.
No. I think the general thing about it is like it's very easy to look at and to understand how you would look at news coverage of this and be like, well, this will like sure, their demands seem fine, but it does seem like they're just trashing their own cities. And, like, certainly that they are. And, like, people are getting injured, and there have been a couple of deaths that aren't, like, you know, it's not like protesters murdering people. It's like accidental deaths relating to it.
Yeah.
But, like, you can view it as that, and then all the good news footage is of, like, smoke billowing next to French, like, nice French buildings. But, like, they do have a legitimate problem with. So we voted you in because we were told that the far-right person would do terrible things with immigration. But yeah, the optics of it on news is clearly like French monuments and then smoke billowing next to them, or really nice old French buildings and smoke billowing next to them, or a fire or a burnt out car. And you're like, well, that is bad. But like, yeah, very much a lot of these, like a lot of people, like Macron did win in a landslide and then won the parliament in a landslide. And you're like, well, why is there such mass protest against him consistently? And it's because they voted for him under the premise of, well, you seem very reasonable, and the far-right person is very unreasonable. And Macron took that as, cool, so I have, like, an enormous mandate for, like, exactly what I want to do. But he very much won in the context of he just about won the first round, and then enormously won the second round, and had and under the momentum that took the parliament. But I don't think you can view that as a, cool, so like you need to make like massive changes to the French labor system, and then also cut tax for rich people because we need more, because like everyone in France historically always agrees we need more wealthy people in because they generate jobs somehow, because they're totally going like and that the French people leaving are then therefore moving their companies with them or whatever. It's not an economic policy that is like truly laid out anywhere. Like there's nowhere which has like massively lowered taxes for rich people and then seen like a massive uptick in like medium-sized businesses. It's not like a direct link, but you know, under the guise of like, but we have to do it for climate reasons, you're raising like you have a flat tax increase on low-income people, but there's no increased like carbon tax or anything that in any way influences industry that, you know, uses lots and lots of fuel for things. It's very much a consumer tax. So it's kind of like you can see why they would be angry about that. And they're not angry specifically because they're like, I don't want to pay an extra €4 per tank of petrol. It's like, well, that's not the problem. It's the in the context of this has been bubbling for a long time and has now come to a head. And it seems petty if you take it on like a lower level, or you want to take it on the I don't like mass uprisings thing, which is also fine, but it's not looking at the whole context.
No. The, yeah.
And also, sorry, just as an aside, like, old people being like, oh, you're trashing Paris, and like, it's a beautiful city, and you've destroyed all these monuments. A lot of their point is that they can't afford to live in Paris because of, like, increasing rents with stagnant wage growth consistently for, like, a large number of years in a row, and then you increase their taxes for the transport they would need to get into Paris.
Yeah, because a lot of these protesters originally came from like cities and towns that are considered like commuter areas.
Yeah,
not necessarily for Paris, but for other major French cities. And a lot of these commuter communities, these, I believe the term is like peri-urban or something like that, where like it's kind of like a community where like the difference between rural and urban is quite blurred and can start and stop at a moment's notice. But like the people who inhabit these communities are, I wouldn't be surprised to find out in like France and other parts of the world, are probably predominantly populated by people who've been pushed out economically of the main urban center they work in.
And thus rely
very much on a car.
Yeah. No, and like Paris is a really good example of that, and that like forced urban sprawl in Paris is an enormous problem and has been continuously in a growing way for decades at this point. And it's kind of like no one has been looking at, you know, stuff that a lot of people want, you know, more social housing in like actual urban centers, for instance. That's not on the cards, but on the cards is like, you've been forced out of Paris and you now have to drive a car. We're gradually making that more and more expensive because we need to for the climate. But the people who are you know, the people that we're also giving tax cuts to rich people who may or may not have made money in heavy industry. So you're just kind of like, well, this is not really, not really one for one. I think there was a quote from some, I can't remember who attributed this to at Politico, but the quote was, who here thinks that when the last time Macron filled his own gas tank was? Like, yeah, like this is a man who's been like enormously wealthy for some time and had a banking industry job and either lived in and was able to afford to live like directly in the center of an urban center and didn't need a car, or had somebody that filled his gas tank for him. So it's kind of a it's the classic like, do you know how much a loaf of bread cost or a pint of milk? And it's like, well, Macron doesn't need to. That's the reality of his life and has been for some time. So the popular uprising against him is understandable, but yeah. I personally, as a consumer, would like to visit Paris, and I would like them to leave the monuments alone while to preserve them for me and not them.
As someone who's been to Paris before and had to pay like €5 for an espresso, my message to the people of France is burn it to the ground, burn it down now. It's your only salvation.
No, but Kieran, I can get the train there from London.
I can get the train there from Berlin. It's exceedingly longer.
Yeah, but you need to preserve the quality. For me, the millennial tourist.
Are those still a thing?
We're a dying breed. anyway, so that's the podcast. Thank you all for listening. It's been a whale of a time.
If you like the show, please tell your friends about it. And, you know, if you've already done that, why not have a small party with you and your friends where you all sit around and give us iTunes reviews? That would be really great. And sure, crack out the wine. It'll be brilliant. At the same time, we have websites. We have one website, previouslyineurope.eu. We have social medias, plural. That's the plural I wanted. Mm-hmm. We're on Facebook. We have a group. You can ask to join, and you can join in on various conversations that we've had. We've talked about a bit of the stuff that we covered on the podcast already in that group, and there's other things we've talked there that we haven't covered in this podcast. Ooh, exclusive content. we also have a Twitter account, @PrevInEurope. There you can see me... rant mostly, probably about the Gilets Jaunes. That's what I've been doing lately. Mm-hmm. Anyway, thanks for listening. Leave us a review, tell a friend, and you know, stay brilliant, you beautiful souls.
And watch out for Ezra Klein.
Watch out for Ezra Klein and his slow takeover of Spanish politics using facts.